Good day, and welcome to the 24th presentation of the Inside the Beltway conference call. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you very much, and hello, everybody. Welcome to Inside the Beltway, and this is going to be one of the more momentous programs that we've had because by sheer accident of timing, we're doing the program the day after the SEC meeting that issued three proposals or three packages of guidance that we will be talking about today. As best as you can talk about 1,000 pages of guidance within a few hours after they've been issued. Before I get into that, though, let me just tell you a little bit about each of us. I'm Fred Riche. I'm a partner with Drinker Biddle in Los Angeles, and I'm chair of the Financial Services ERISA team, meaning that we're a group that focuses on fiduciary and prohibited transaction issues for service providers to plans, participants, and IRAs. With me is Brad Campbell from our Washington, D.C. office. Brad is a partner and also, very importantly, the former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration, which in a subsequent regime issued the fiduciary rule that the Fifth Circuit vacated a few weeks ago. And also with me is a partner from the firm's Chicago office, Jim Lundy. Jim Lundy was, in a prior life, an SEC attorney, and Jim is going to take the leadership and the discussion today about the materials, the guidance, the proposed guidance that the SEC issued yesterday. Also with me is Jim Dolan. Jim is a vice president of retirement strategies with Natixis Investment Managers. And what's important is that Natixis sponsors these programs so that we can afford to provide these free conference calls to you all once a quarter. And Jim, I want to thank you for that. That's a great service to provide good education to the benefits community. And let me turn it over to you for a second, Jim.
Thanks so much, Fred. Really do appreciate the partnership. And these are great calls, really educational. And it's really exciting to be able to have this call today right on the heels of the announcement. So thank you for everyone calling in today to spend the time with us and to learn all that we'll learn today. For those of you that aren't familiar with Natixis Investment Managers, we're a multi-boutique mutual fund company. We have investment managers across fixed income, alternatives, and equities. I'm excited to share with you that we were recognized for 2017's Mutual Fund Manager of the Year by Barron's, which is always great news, and also share with you a new focus of our retirement group, which is our sustainable future funds. These are ESG target dates products for 401k plans to allow investors to align their values with their investments. So again, Fred, I want to thank you, everyone, for calling in today, and Drinker Biddle for the partnership.
Well, Jim, thank you very much, and thanks to Natixis. You guys have been great. Well, let's move on to the other Jim, Jim Lundy, our Chicago SEC partner. But before I do that, let me give a brief introduction to what Jim's going to talk about. Yesterday, the Securities and Exchange Commission met and voted to release three proposals. The proposals were listed on their agenda. The first was whether to propose new and amended rules and forms to require registered investment advisors and registered broker-dealers to provide a brief relationship summary to retail customers. So this is called a relationship summary, and as Jim will explain, there are four-page documents that will describe the business models and the standards of care conflicts, among other things. Think of it as a very short ADV of sorts. The second, and that proposal passed 4-1. The second agenda item was whether to propose a rule to establish a standard of conduct for broker-dealers and their associated persons when making recommendations of any securities transaction or investment strategy involving a retail customer. In other words, a standard of care for broker-dealers. the proposal passed 4-1. So both those are out there. And the third one, to eliminate the suspense, also passed 4-1 among the five commissioners. The third category that they were going to consider was whether to propose a commission interpretation of the standard of conduct for investment advisors. So you have standard of conduct for investment advisors on the table, standard of conduct for broker-dealers, and a relationship summary document. And at the end of the commission meeting yesterday, they released almost 1,000 pages of materials. And at that point, my expertise ends and Jim's begins. So, Jim, let me turn it over to you.
Sure. Thank you, Fred. Good day, everyone. I'm actually going to save the discussion on what's being called Form CRS until we talk about the other two issues, because I think that will flow a little bit better, because I think one of the goals of the form is to try to bridge the gap a little bit further, a little bit closer, pardon me, between the standards for broker-dealers and registered investment advisors as contemplated potentially with these proposals as they move forward through the comment period and final rule. First, just a little bit of background, because I think it helps us get the perspective of the commissioners and their staff. Prior to the Fifth Circuit striking down the DOL fiduciary rule, the SEC experienced something similar about a decade ago. The SEC made an attempt to propose a rule. It was finalized and issued under the Advisors Act called Rule 202A11-1. It was challenged by the Financial Planning Association, and the D.C. Circuit vacated that 2005 rule in 2007. And so there was a bit of sensitivity going into the process with that perspective. While the commissioners are new and many of the senior officers are new, many of the senior staff reporting to the directors were there at that time and in all likelihood worked on that prior rule as well. So underlying all of this, I think, is a goal to have a rule go through the comment process and get finalized that will be workable for the industry, be workable for investors, and also be affirmed, if so challenged, on appeal by an industry group or an investor advocacy group or any other constituency such as that. So with that all said, I'll start with regulation best interest. I was talking with Fred and Brad a little bit earlier, and I think, again, by way of background, and this was talked about by the commissioners, while Section 15 of the Securities Exchange Act and the rules thereunder have a variety of regulatory requirements for broker-dealers and relating to how they interact with their customers, this type of language is not present currently in the statutes or in the rules thereunder. Where most of the regulatory focus has been in these particular types of interactions with the customer base has been in the FINRA rulebook, pursuant to their suitability rules, which the brokerage industry has obviously developed, supervisory processes, control functions, and entire compliance infrastructure across the industry for decades. But this is really the SEC's first foray into that space, putting a rule in place under Section 15 that will allow the SEC to play a much larger role in the regulation and enforcement of the brokerage industry's interaction with retail customers. And I mentioned the FINRA background because I think it's very important, because when you look at the draft proposed rule of regulation best interest, which was attached as Annex A to the chairman's overview of the standards, and so it's easily accessible, and that will prevent those of you who don't want to pour through 450 pages, you can just click on his overview, and it's right there in a link. And it's only about 2 pages long. And in the middle of the standards, there's three small Roman numerals. In the middle one is care obligation. And within there, there's subparagraphs A, B, and C. When you read those subparagraphs, and if you have a dual screen like most of us, and you hold them up to how FINRA characterizes their suitability obligations and categorizes the three areas under FINRA Rule 2111, they read almost verbatim. Subparagraph A speaks of a reasonable basis and focuses on the potential risks and rewards of the recommendation. Sounds exactly the same as the reasonable basis suitability obligations under the FINRA rules. Subparagraph B under the care obligation section of Reg BI talks about the recommendation being in the best interest of a particular retail customer based on that customer's investment profile and risks and rewards. Sounds very similar to what we're all familiar with in the brokerage industry and what's known as customer-specific suitability. And then lastly, subparagraph C talks about a series of recommended transactions, and that series, if excessive, will not be viewed in isolation, et cetera, et cetera. This sounds very much like the concept of quantitative suitability under the FINRA rules. So I think the floor established by Reg BI was for the SEC to say, we are going to codify in the SEC's rules and regs a suitability regime that is very similar to FINRA. And there may be a variety of reasons for that. One of them may be, as they thought about how to roll out a proposed rule for a standard of care for broker-dealers and retail customers, they would have to survive the cost-benefit analysis and requirements needed for the rule to be sustainable. And the SEC has lost on appeal when the cost-benefit analysis has not been done correctly. I think they've positioned themselves well to say, while there will be internal costs associated with the implementation of this rule, those costs should be somewhat manageable because these particular subparagraphs under the care obligation are consistent with the FINRA suitability concepts that every brokerage firm who is a member of FINRA currently needs to be in compliance with. Now, where we get to suitability plus is in the first and third part of Reg BI, the disclosure obligations regarding material facts relating to the scope and terms of the relationship, including all material conflicts of interest related to the recommendation, and also the third section on conflict of interest obligations to identify all material conflicts, including any financial incentives that present a material conflict. Those disclosure obligations are above and beyond the middle part of the draft Reg BI, in that it's not just a suitability obligation, but now affirmative disclosure obligations on broker-dealers serving retail customers. So that starts to move a little bit towards what we've seen historically in the SEC registered investment advisor space. But where it stops short is we do not see the word fiduciary used in Reg BI, nor do we see a definition of what the term best interest means. And for those of you who watched the open meeting yesterday, you likely heard that repeatedly by Commissioner Stein, but also, interestingly enough, her fellow commissioners who had some differing views, in Commissioner Pierce in particular, also, though, noted that a definitional explanation of best interest was not included in this proposed rule. Because they are both on opposite sides of the aisle and spoke openly about commonality on this issue, I don't want to predict the future, but there is a chance that we could see through the comment process and as the staff moves towards drafting a final rule, some work done to try to develop something that would address that issue that's been flagged by two commissioners who come from different parties and brought different perspectives based on their comments. So we may see some development in that space in a final rule. With that said, Fred, I'm prepared to shift to the standard of conduct for investment advisors and enhancing the investment advisor regulation based on the 38-page proposal that was also issued last evening.
Yeah, Jim, maybe Brad and I could pitch in a little bit here because we don't have your background as a securities lawyer, so we've seen the world for years through the lens of ERISA and the fiduciary standard, the prudent man rule, and the duty of loyalty. A couple of things that I don't know if you can help us out, but I think particularly the Chairman Clayton referred to a duty of loyalty on a couple of occasions. And I assume the duty of loyalty is all three, the disclosure obligation, the care obligation, and the conflict of interest obligation together, because there's nothing that really says duty of loyalty. It does refer to that the broker-dealer or the representative in making a recommendation must exercise reasonable diligence, care, skill, and prudence. And prudence caught my eye because, you know, as an ERISA fiduciary guy, there's the prudent man rule. There, you know, the whole fiduciary concept is based on prudence. But anyway, it says that reasonable diligence, care, skill, and prudence to have a reasonable basis to believe that the recommendation is in the best interest of the particular customer. And I thought maybe that best interest was the duty of loyalty, but I can't really place his duty of loyalty comments together with anything that exactly corresponds to that in the guidance. What do you think about that?
Well, I have two thoughts. The first is the comments in the whole entire body of the release related to the proposed rule, as you explained, I think delve into greater detail and I think reflect more thought about more work to be done that will move this reg best interest perhaps a little bit closer to where the DOL is and where the rules and regulations regarding investment advisors are. I don't think we will get to the point where the commission is going to finalize a rule that says you have a fiduciary duty, Mr. Broker-Dealer or Mrs. Broker-Dealer. That's not going to happen. They made that very clear. They made it very clear in the proposals. The other thing I think that you know, for those of you who watch the commissioner's statements, is you really got to go read the rules and the releases because the duty of loyalty is a specific topic for the enhanced investment advisor regulation proposed rule, and is discussed in detail in that release. And I think at times, because these were all being talked about collectively, and as we all know, it's part of why there's confusion in this space, I think there were references to a duty of loyalty that may have been mistakenly talked about when they were talking about reg best interest. Because while that detail I think is helpful, Fred, and I think it's indicative of where we may see a best interest being defined within the four corners of the rule, you know, the rule as is, if it were finalized today, does not have any of that language. And when the staff ultimately goes in and examines registrants, and if they consider enforcement referrals and actions being taken, they can, in a persuasive way, look to the language in these published, proposed preambles that go on for hundreds of pages, but typically they're limited to the four corners of the document. And the four corners of the document that currently has proposed reg best interest doesn't have references to any of those terms. But I think reading behind it and looking into the detail in that 400-page release, I think we are going to see clarity in what best interest means in a final rule. I'm predicting the future. I could be wrong. But I think the detail that you talked about, Fred, is going to be indicative of that, particularly when, as I said, we already have commissioners flagging this issue.
Yeah, and as a follow-up on that, Jim, a couple of commissioners, perhaps three even, said comment on the fact that the rule itself, the proposed rule, would require broker-dealers and their representatives to adhere to best interest. You know, just the words, but did not define it. Which almost makes me feel that and other things that are absent, almost makes me feel that this was rushed out, that it was only a partially done product, but for some reason they decided to publish it now. Jim and Brad, any thoughts on that?
Well, this is Brad. I think, Fred, that you're on to something there, and I think that's actually one of the reasons why there is some very clear ambiguity in the text. I think the SEC is at sort of a crossroads in terms of its jurisdiction and its sort of primacy as a financial regulator, in that when the Department of Labor under the Obama administration moved forward independently and unilaterally with the DOL fiduciary rule, it really sort of superseded the SEC's jurisdiction in a number of areas. And now that the Fifth Circuit has vacated the rule And while, again, we don't officially know that DOL is not going to appeal, they only have until the end of the month to do so, and it looks as though DOL is not going to appeal, so the Fifth Circuit ruling probably will go into effect on May 7th and vacate the rule. But with that opportunity, the SEC now no longer has to adjust itself to fit what DOL's already done. The SEC can now lead the way and have DOL adjust itself to the SEC's rule. That's one aspect. The other is you have the CFP board trying to move forward with some standards. You have a variety of states who are perceiving a void in financial regulation by virtue of the Fifth Circuit ruling, who are beginning to, thinking about, and in a couple of states' examples, taking concrete steps towards putting out their own fiduciary or best interest standards. And I think the SEC as an institution needed to move quickly and get in front of this to remind people that they're there and that they're on top of it and they're going to do something about it. And that's in part, I think, why we got a 4-1 decision, why we had bipartisanship in that response, even though very clearly, I think, from their statements, the commissioners are not all uniformly on the same page, in fact, are somewhat uncomfortable with what's been done so far. So I think you're exactly right, Fred. I think this was moving quickly in order to fill a perceived void, and that it moved on an institutional interest basis rather than a specifics of these proposals basis.
I couldn't agree more, Brad. I think Commissioner Jackson said certain things along those points. And the other thing that I think is indicative of what Fred raised and what you just talked through, Brad, is the repeated reference to how important comments by industry groups, by firms, by individuals. It's always important, particularly for something this high profile, but it led me to believe what you had started with, Fred, that this is not a finished product. This is a product that is maybe a little closer to the starting line than the finish line, believe it or not, and that we may see some material and substantive changes in a final rule when we get there. So I think people and firms should really embrace that invitation and think about how to put together the best comment letters they can to have their voices heard. I think there's a very strong interest to have those voices be heard and to help be part of the process to get to the final rule.
Yeah, Jim, I couldn't agree more, and that's something we're already talking to our clients about here just on, day one of the proposal is, how can we help you get those comment letters where they need to be? Because I think you said it well, whereas I think typically when a federal agency goes forward with a proposed regulation, their minds are 80 or 90% made up about what they want to do. They take comments to find surprises. They take comments to solve some of the particular issues that maybe they're not sure about. But mostly they know where they're going and how they're going to get there. And unless something unusual happens, the final rule is going to look pretty similar to the proposal. This one, I think, is quite different. I think you're getting a very vague initial product because so many of these questions aren't settled.
One thing I've noticed in the comment letters I've seen people submit is that it's all written from their perspective, from the business's perspective, which illustrates to me that they don't understand that the better way to comment to a regulator is to take what you know about your business and then frame it and describe it in a way that it matters to the regulator, because the regulator has a mission. And if it can be described within the scope of the mission of the regulator, it'll be a more impactful letter. It'll be seen as more thoughtful and not just as espousing something for the benefit of the business, but not necessarily for the industry or the consumer. That's where somebody like Jim has a big advantage on comment letters to the SEC, because he's been there. He's lived that life. And Brad over at the DOL, similarly. So. And I agree. Boy, if there was ever a time to file comment letters, this is the time, because it seems to me the lot is up in the air. Jim, one last comment before I go on. As you've described, it appears to be an enhanced suitability and certainly not a fiduciary standard for broker-dealers. One comment on that, if I were a judge, in other words, if I had no background in the securities law, but I were a judge, and I read this, and I read the word prudence, and I read the words best interest that are in the rule, actually inside the rule itself, or the proposed rule. I would view that as, I would probably see that as requiring more than suitability. Not that it's sort of okay for you, but that it actually has to be pretty good for you. And the minute you make that shift, even though you don't call it a fiduciary rule, I could see how a judge might view it as analogous to a fiduciary rule without the label, because prudence and best interest are words commonly associated with a fiduciary standard. So, but I don't have the background in the securities industry to know what guidance there is out there that has otherwise interpreted that language in a way that might be more consistent with suitability. So in a properly briefed case, even as a judge, I might turn around on that. But I worry a little bit that there is some language in there that, if cherry-picked, would suggest something higher than suitability. Talking about fiduciaries, Jim, what about the guidance on RIAs? What did it do conceptually? How was it put together? What's it all about?
Sure, I'm happy to get into that. Can I make one comment, Fred, on your comment about a judge?
Yeah.
It's a very real risk. In a former life, I was an enforcement lawyer and a litigator for the SEC, and if there is ambiguity in a rule and a lack of case law interpreting that rule, you look exactly where you mentioned, Fred, which is those lengthy hundreds of pages supporting the rule, and you pull out things like prudence and, well, maybe not specifically mentioned, allusions to the fiduciary rule. And as an enforcement lawyer, I would be quoting that in my briefs and arguing that should be the standard. And if I argue that successfully, then we now have regulation by enforcement, which does happen regularly, we all know. But I think one of the goals here in all of these proposed rules is to provide clarity. And I think they need to get more clear with Reg BI, particularly with the definition of that particular term and perhaps in other ways, to avoid what you just talked about vis-a-vis a judge or what I mentioned as a possible strategy for the enforcement division. They'll use those strategies to be successful in their cases regardless, but there's definitely a little bit of a gap here that needs to be closed as the SEC moves towards a final rule for BI.
Great.
So for the request for comment on enhancing investment advisor regulation, I think back, Fred, to when we started working together and talking about the fiduciary rule of the DOL, and I know at one point I told you that if you were to take a Word version of the Investment Advisors Act and go on the find function and type in the word fiduciary, that you wouldn't see it in there. And I've never read it word for word, but if you read the first couple pages of the release, they pretty much say that. This is a common law evolved concept, and that's fine. It's a concept that the regulators, the industry, and investors have accepted for decades. And it evolved from a famous Supreme Court case back in 1963 called SEC versus Capital Gains Research. And since that time, various cases have interpreted this fiduciary standard, and they've applied it to a particular section of the Advisors Act, Section 206, which is the anti-fraud provision of that act. But the standard is nothing more than the common law principal agency fiduciary standard and everything that goes along with it. And as I said, while it's been well accepted, and I think the industry and industry groups accept their role as fiduciaries, it still could have used some clarity. It still could have used some rulemaking so that the industry and the investors know what exactly that means. And that's what this effort is all about, to take this common law concept that, while well accepted, is a very high-level general common law fiduciary concept and move it forward with some guidance that will provide clarity that I think is going to enhance it. And I think we were talking earlier, ironically enough, I think coming out of these proposals, there will likely be more costs and burdens associated with this particular proposal, because I think folks will need to assess how these enhancements align with what's been developed over the industry, what's been developed by the regulators, and what investor expectations are as they've developed over the decades. So what they've put out in the proposal is to establish specifically in an Investment Advisors Act rule that there will be a duty of care required under the fiduciary duty of an investment advisor, a duty to provide advice that is in the client's best interest. And just to digress for a second, there's that term best interest again, and we see it discussed in the proposed rule. However, it's being talked about in a different light here because it falls under the concept of the fiduciary obligation of the investment advisor. And as I continue to talk through this, we do need to remember that while the lanes have moved closer, the Commission was very clear that there is no uniform standard and no fiduciary duty for broker-dealers. So Reg BI, we are done talking about. We're now talking about the fiduciary duty for registered investment advisors, which, again, speaks to this best interest and a duty for the advisor to provide advice accordingly in that regard. Secondly is the duty of best execution, and then the duty to act and provide advice and monitoring over the course of the relationship. Those three, the duty to provide advice in the best interest, seek best execution, and advice and monitoring over the course of the relationship, fall under the duty of care that I mentioned at the start. And then the second large duty being imposed enhanced, and for which the SEC is providing more clarity, is the duty of loyalty to the investment advisory customers. So, I think Brad said when we were talking a little bit before and preparing, it's a bit ironic that it seems like more is being put upon the investment advisors who we're actually closer to the DOL fiduciary rule in terms of their practices, and who I think even vis-a-vis the industry groups have, particularly over the last year or two, said they are fully accepting of their fiduciary obligations. Yet this proposal, I think, is going to be perhaps, ironically enough, more burdensome because there does have to be this assessment by firms to make sure that the specific enhancements that are being proposed here are in fact aligned with the compliance operations and processes and supervisory functions of the firms.
Jim, a couple things that I noticed when I looked through this, and then I'm going to ask Brad what he's thinking about, but a couple things I noticed were, even though it talks in terms of a duty to monitor, there is a comment in there about how, for example, a financial planner might give one-time advice about investment strategies, and if you contract, based on that, it appears to me if you contract to give one-time advice, you're a fiduciary for that one-time advice, but you don't have an ongoing duty to monitor. I would think that RIA should be very clear about that in their agreements, if that's the case. But so I guess what I'm saying is it doesn't seem there's always going to be a duty to monitor unless that's part of the arrangement between the investor and the advisor. Do you see it the same way?
I do. I think like with any proposal that comes out, there will be clarity that the expectation is that the final rules will be implemented in a way that will be tailored to the business of the firms and to the business relationships that the firm has with their clients. So for one-time interactions, I think you're right, Fred. The duty to monitor is not going to be applicable.
Yeah, and then another thing I noticed both in regulation best interest for broker-dealers, regulation BI as people are calling it, and the consolidation of guidance on RIAs, which we see as actually enhancing or increasing the requirements on RIAs. In both of them, if you do a word search for rollovers throughout the preamble and the rule, there are multiple hits in both of them. So for the SEC has concluded, at least in this proposed form, that the staff, I guess more accurately, but adopted as a proposal by the commissioners, for both broker-dealers and for RIAs, that a recommendation to take a rollover is a securities recommendation and therefore is subject to these new standards. So I think there is, at least to a degree, a convergence that will be of the SEC and the DOL that will also be enforced by FINRA, that rollovers are securities transactions and will be regulated and examined by all of the agencies. And we still have to wait and see what the National Association of Insurance Commissioners does over on the insurance side of the house. But I was pretty, I was struck by that, because that is a, hundreds of billions of dollars are being rolled out of plans every year, and those are all going to be more regulated, I believe. Brad, I don't, do you want to jump in now with any thoughts on the guidance on RIAs?
Yeah, well, Jim, as you mentioned, when we were talking about this before the call and sort of comparing notes on what we thought about what we'd read, it did strike me that this proposed rule went farther than I think probably a lot of observers were anticipating on enhancing some of the requirements related to what it means to be a securities law fiduciary, to be an RIA or an IAR for an RIA under this proposal. And the format it takes really is a very long series of questions about what they should do, the commission should do in this area, in figuring out how to express some of these fiduciary obligations. And I think this is, again, one of those areas where the comments are going to be really important. For folks out there who are in the RIA space, I think you really want to pay some attention to this, because the kinds of issues that are going to come up here are similar to the distinctions between being an ERISA fiduciary and a securities fiduciary, and what's all the sort of baggage that comes with that. One of the reasons the DOL fiduciary rule was so significant is that under the duty of loyalty and then under the express prohibited transaction provisions, a lot of things that would be permissible under securities law in terms of compensation and conflicts would not be permissible under ERISA. And if they're moving the standard on what's loyalty, if they're moving the standard on, particularly here in this proposal, it talks about the requirement to not just identify but also mitigate certain conflicts. If they're moving the position the securities industry has traditionally had on how you deal with conflicts for RIAs, that is a potentially pretty material change and getting closer to the ERISA model than it has been to the traditional securities model. So that's an area where I think comments are going to be really important, and people need to pay attention to that. One last thing I noticed, which I actually thought was helpful, was there's a fairly good discussion of fees and the significance of fees and how fees stack up as a factor to be considered by a fiduciary under securities law. And I thought it was helpful in that it reiterated that fees, as we've been saying in the ERISA context for a long time, fees are not the factor, they are a factor. They're a relevant factor, they're important in the decision-making, but they're not the end-all, be-all question, and you do not have an obligation to pick the cheapest investment, that the decision is based on the totality of all the relevant factors, of which fees are one. So I thought that was actually a helpful discussion to have reiterated by the SEC in there, even as I thought in general this was moving the needle on some of the fiduciary obligations in a way that seemed very material to me compared to what I've traditionally understood securities law fiduciary obligation to be. But that's where I'll defer to you, Jim, because you know that side far better than I do.
No, I agree, Brad. I mean, as I said at the start, I think they're attempting to enhance and clarify here, but I think they went a little further than people expected. Now, that said, I do think there's a balance, because I think a lot of firms may already have some processes in place that are consistent with what the guidance is here. But when we were talking about cost-benefit earlier, ironically, I think this can be more costly from an internal and perhaps external perspective, because you're still going to have to do an assessment to make sure you have the right processes in place so you have supervisory and compliance functions to assess that, you know, your IRA reps, pardon me, your RIA reps, are doing all of these things that are articulated here in this release. And, I think every firm's going to have to do it. And I think there's going to be some that are going to have enhancements that will develop from that to make sure that ultimately their processes align with what the SEC is going to put out there.
Jim, I just noticed the time. In the interest of time, why don't you move on to that the relationship document, and tell us a little more about that.
Sure, and I'm glad we saved this for last. I think the goal of this document is to try to bridge the gap that the SEC still wants to have in place with more traditional broker-dealer regulation akin to the suitability plus model, which, as I said, at least I believe is where Reg BI currently stands, and the investment advisory traditional fiduciary relationship. So the goals of this are to have the BDs and IAs provide direct and clear guidance in their communications with prospective and current investors. And there's also the title piece to it, Fred, and we talked about that because in the early release it wasn't clear about that, but as I suspected, it's folded up under here. I think there'll be some criticism in the comments that perhaps they didn't go far enough because they only picked two particular words, advisor with an E and advisor with an O. I think we're likely at the starting point of that discussion, and based on the comment letters, we'll see additional clarity. But I think most importantly is that the form is going to call for fee, conflict, and other material disclosures, including the principal types of services offered, the legal standards that apply to broker-dealers versus RIAs, the fees, and other conflicts that may be material. All, I think, very valid and very important goals out of this process. That said, I went and read templates, the dual registrant template, the brokerage account template, and the investment advisory account template, and I started to read the 450-plus pages of the proposed rule that align with this. And as I think Chairman Clayton or another commissioner said, this all needs a lot of work. These forms and this rule that are designed to make things easier for retail investors are anything but. They're documents that were written by securities lawyers for securities lawyers. I think several commissioners pointed out that one of the goals here is that this does not turn into a prospectus-like document that we all receive, and myself included, are guilty of immediately turning around and putting in the circular file. They do not want that to happen. The commissioners have more altruistic goals than that for the purpose of this document. So I think of all three proposals, this one has the most work to do. I mean, if you just think of it as a reasonable person, if you have a four-page document that's supposed to be very, very clear for retail investors to cut through this confusion that has built up over the decades, why do you need a proposed rule in excess of 450 pages to explain that? So I think there's going to be a lot of work to be done in this space. For firms and individuals and advocacy groups that have an interest in this space, I think there's going to be a lot of traction that the commission will be receptive to and their staffs will be receptive to regarding comments. I think while all of the commissioners were consistent that they want to see a form like this, I think the term you used, Fred, was kind of like a quasi-mini form ADV. They want that regulatory form around this initial interaction, and I think it's going to happen. I just don't think it's going to look like this because this is way too complicated, way too convoluted, and it just needs a lot of work to get boiled down to a format that's going to work for what they want to be just a basic communication tool for retail investors.
Yeah, I think, Jim, one of the commissioners actually said that he'd put it through a software program to design to determine the level of education or knowledge needed to read and understand it, and it was beyond the level of the average investor. So didn't Commissioner Clayton say it was written by securities lawyers for lawyers?
Yeah, I think Clayton said that, and it was Pivovar who said he put this through that, and I forgot the name of the system that you used, but it was essentially someone with an advanced degree was needed to understand the terminology in here based on the verbiage that was used.
Yeah. Yeah, I looked at it. They look like pre-printed forms to me. I have to admit, I might be one of those people that would put it in the circular file. Just one more form that you're handed as a part of the process. So, Jim, is that it? Can we move on to Brad, or did you want to add more?
No, and I didn't mean to be overly critical of it, because I think ultimately we're going to see something come out of this. I think they want the form to work. I think to get back to what we've talked about earlier, this may be the most striking example of while I think the commissioners and their staffs and the staff at the SEC who developed it, I think they all want this to work. But this felt the most rushed of all three items on the agenda to me. And they all felt rushed, but this felt the most.
Yeah, good. Hey, Brad, I want to leave a little time for questions at the end, but I got a couple of things I'd like for you to cover on the agenda. Earlier you mentioned that the Fifth Circuit, that the DOL has until April 30th, generally speaking, to challenge the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decision. And if they don't, it will become applicable on May 7th. That is the order vacating the rule. What kind of odds would you place on it, and what other thoughts do you have?
Yeah, I'd say the odds are pretty high at this point. I know a lot of people came right out of the gate as soon as the Fifth Circuit decision came out and said DOL wouldn't appeal, this was going to happen for sure. I was not in that camp initially because there were several other factors at work here. The decision sort of implicated questions more broadly speaking on regulatory policy, you know, in terms of potential effects on what's called Chevron deference, in other words, how courts review agency actions. Under prior court decisions, how much deference do the courts give to the agencies? Is it de novo review? All of those kinds of issues. And there were concerns about that. There have also been concerns. The Department of Justice has had a ongoing dispute with the federal courts over the ability of a district court to strike down a federal regulation, to strike it down nationally. And the Department of Justice has generally been appealing those decisions. Here it's a circuit court, and here the policy outcome probably is in line with what the administration wants. So I think over the course of the last several weeks, there's been a lot more debate internally, and I think those issues are starting to get sorted out. And I think on balance, we're going to not see the Department of Labor appeal, even though I don't think that decision technically has been made yet. And as you say, they have until April 30th to decide. But I think it's very likely, I'd say 80-90%, that they will not appeal, despite some of the concerns that were there about those other issues, and that we will see the rule be vacated. The effect of that, though, is really one that's going to cause some confusion and problems going forward, and that's because in some ways this is the right decision, at least that's an opinion, let me be clear. I think it's the right decision, but it may be coming at the wrong time in the sense that the industry has been operating under the transition period with the DOL fiduciary rule implemented for a year, essentially, the better part of a year. And we've relied on the exemptions, like the transition best interest contract exemption, to let various financial institutions be fiduciaries despite having some variable compensation, despite having some conflicts that would otherwise not be permissible but for the BIC exemption. So if this rule does go, if the ruling goes into effect and the DOL fiduciary rule is vacated on May 7th, it's going to create some transition issues for a number of financial institutions who will no longer have the BIC exemption because the rule is vacating not just the expanded definition of fiduciary, but all of the exemptions and changes that were made as well. So we won't have the BIC exemption at all. So that's going to create problems for those who are fiduciaries but have compensation arrangements that relied on the BIC exemption to be permissible. And so going forward, there's going to be a lot of discussion with the Labor Department saying, will you issue a new exemption that provides BIC-like relief, or will you issue an enforcement policy at the least that indicates you won't be pursuing prohibited transaction violations where we've adopted policies and procedures that were modeled on the fiduciary rule, which now has been vacated. So there's going to be a number of issues that we're going to have to sort through. Another one is rollovers. You know, what is the position of the Department of Labor on rollovers? Presumably it reverts back to the 2005 advisory opinion, which said that it was not fiduciary advice to recommend a rollover unless you were a fiduciary to the plan the rollover was coming from. And in that instance, we then have the question of whether giving that advice is a prohibited transaction for that fiduciary. And in the guidance, DOL had merely said it may be. So without the BIC exemption, in those cases where rollover advice is fiduciary advice, is there a prohibited transaction, and is there an exemption that would address it if there is? So we go back to some pre-existing gray area questions that we had before the fiduciary rule that'll now come back. And so one of the questions is, will DOL address rollover issues in new guidance, assuming the rule is vacated? So we're heading into a period of probably some significant uncertainty and transitional discomfort, to use a more clinical term, that we're going to have to sort through for a lot of clients. And we've been talking with clients about this now for several weeks and trying to figure out how to position ourselves for the next round. I think it's fair to say that DOL has been waiting for the SEC to act to see where it's going so that DOL can figure out how to respond. And now that we do have some SEC activity, I think we're going to be able to have more substantive discussions with DOL in the next couple of months.
Great. Well, thank you. Let's go to some of the pre-submitted questions now. The first one is, says the marketplace has changed already due to the fiduciary rule, which, as Brad explained, may be vacated shortly. And companies have spent millions of dollars to develop systems and procedures and policies. Are people really going to go back if the rule is vacated, back to the old way? I was at the SIFMA conference a few weeks ago, and attorneys on the panel from various large broker-dealers said no, they're not going to go back, at least on everything, that they have with the new systems and procedures and approaches that they've developed internally. They actually really like some of them. They feel that it is, from their perspective, a better way to do business, and they're going to keep them in place. But, you know, let's not forget that the regulation, for example, of rollovers, that the SEC, as I pointed out earlier, is also going to regulate and examine that. FINRA, under Regulatory Notice 13-45, is also going to be doing that. So, people still have to have a rollover process in place, and they have to gather data, they have to evaluate it, regardless of whether the standard is suitability, reasonable basis, or prudence. There's still a requirement to compare the account inside the plan with the account in the IRA, based on the investor's needs, circumstances, risk tolerance, and so on, objectives. It's going to be a broker-dealer by broker-dealer, RIA by RIA decision, but I think a lot of it is here to stay, and I think the three regulators are converging on many of these issues, such that those programs will be appropriate going forward, the ones developed for the fiduciary rule. By the way, I think the trend towards level fee investment advice is also going to continue based on the comments from some of the speakers at the SIFMA conference that advised accounts may continue to grow, particularly for larger accounts, and transaction-based accounts will still be there for people who want to be more engaged in the transactions and for smaller accounts where they might just be placed into a mutual fund. Brad, the next one actually is sort of in your area. How do you think this is going to impact insurance-licensed only agents who sell fixed indexed annuities and fixed rate annuities? What's the fallout on that?
Yeah, well, first of all, I would say we've seen nothing from the SEC whatsoever to suggest that they're trying to expand the definition of what's a security. So it appears that the current line between, you know, variable annuities and fixed annuities, which are securities products, which are insurance products, that appears to not be at issue. So that part will stay the same. Where we're seeing a lot of activity is obviously at the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the NAIC. They're developing a model rule for a best interest standard in annuity transactions. So that's one area where we're going to be seeing probably change at the state level, particularly for the insurance-licensed only folks. And, of course, in New York State, they've put out a proposal to adopt a basically adopt the DOL standard of best interest for not only annuity transactions but also life insurance transactions. So New York is way out of step, I would say. I don't want to say ahead. That implies that it's progress. I think actually the New York proposal is very problematic. But they put out the proposal. They took comments on it. And now they're going to issue a revised proposal based on those comments sometime in the near future. We're waiting to see how that proposal might change in response both to the comments and to the Fifth Circuit action, because one of New York's rationales for acting was that the Department of Labor had created an unlevel playing field with two different standards for annuity sales in New York, so they wanted to bring the state standard to the DOL standard to achieve uniformity. But, of course, if the DOL standard is vacated, there goes part of the rationale for New York acting at all. So not to get bogged down in New York, but just to point out that there are certain actions taking place there. The rollover space, I think, is going to be an interesting one, because if we no longer have most rollover transactions being fiduciary advice under the DOL definition, and in many cases I think people will be able to argue that it doesn't meet the five-part test because it's one-time advice, not regularly provided advice, that will affect some of the requirements that are in place for dealing with the DOL fiduciary aspect of it. But, of course, we are reverting back to the traditional form of 8424, the exemption for annuities and insurance contracts. So I think there's a lot of moving pieces here, but I think in terms of the short term, it might be easier for some of the insurance license-only folks because they probably will be able to not be fiduciaries under the old five-part test that's going to come back. But it's not a, it is a case-by-case issue that we're going to have to look at.
Yeah, I think the main issue there is whether or not the insurance agent is giving advice on a regular basis. So if they're meeting with a customer every year to help with the fixed indexed annuity, that might be viewed as a regular basis, and the chance of them being a fiduciary increases. If a product is sold and then for the next several years there's no ongoing advice, then it's probably a sale and not a fiduciary recommendation. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but that's just an example of how the rule will apply. Recommendations to plans are like distributions and rollovers, probably not on an ongoing basis, but they are subject to ERISA. And there is a private right of action there. Recommendations to IRAs, there are prohibited transactions for fiduciary advice resulting in the payment of a commission, but only the IRS can enforce the Internal Revenue Code. So there has been no enforcement activity there, which is sort of a long-winded way of saying it's a mess. But it probably, as Brad said, frees up insurance agents, particularly independent insurance agents, from fiduciary status for the time being.
To follow up that thought very briefly, though, and I will be quick, one of the challenges, though, I think, for the insurance carriers is that there isn't going to, because this is situationally based, in other words, how often am I providing advice is one of the factors as to whether ERISA fiduciary status applies. It makes it very difficult, I think, for the carrier to figure out what a blanket policy and procedure should be for how their agents should act when some of the agents in the course of that business will become fiduciaries and some won't, just based on how the tests apply to their particular circumstance. So I don't want to say that it's going to be easy. I think there is a somewhat of a liberating effect on insurance agents, but it might actually be more frustrating for carriers because now there's not a hard and fast rule one way or the other.
Yeah, one last quick question, and then we'll wrap up. By the way, as you can tell, we favor the pre-submitted questions. We want to make, if people go to that effort, we want to make sure to try to answer them. And we answer them either in the presentation or as questions at the end. The last one is, what about wholesalers and distributors? Under the fiduciary rule that may be vacated shortly, wholesalers can become fiduciaries by making recommendations to advisors. Generally speaking, there's a concept called an independent fiduciary with financial expertise, which is an exception to the fiduciary rule, so they're not. The one place where that doesn't help for a variety of technical reasons is advice to independent insurance agents. my interpretation is that if the fiduciary rule goes away, if it's vacated, there, I don't know, I'm not aware of anything else, and Brad, jump in if you are, of anything else that says advice to a fiduciary advisor is fiduciary advice. I think the old rules were more structured on advice to the investor rather than advice to an advisor. But so I think some of those issues may be alleviated there as well. Brad, do you have any thoughts on that?
I would agree with that. I think that's the kind of thing somebody is probably going to approach the Labor Department for some clarification on. But really, this whole problem of, you know, the wholesalers becoming fiduciaries by talking to financial professionals was created by the way the DOL fiduciary rule was drafted, where it just said talking to a fiduciary was, you know, one of the triggers. So that could be a fiduciary by virtue of being a service provider, not limited to plan investment committee members, for example. So I think the problem was created by the fiduciary rule. I think it'll go away with the fiduciary rule, but I wouldn't be surprised if someone tries to get a, you know, belt and suspenders answer from DOL on it.
Okay, well, we're going to have at our next, a calendar quarter from now, at our next Beltway call, we're going to be able to talk about the comment letters and give some specific direction on where we think this is going. And in fact, speaking of the next Beltway call, Jim Dolan, let me turn it over to you.
Thanks so much, Fred. And Brad, thanks for the insight. And I want to thank Jim Lundy for sharing all of his expertise today. It was really helpful. So if you could mark your calendar for July 24th, that will be our next call. And with that, I'm happy to turn it over to the operator to close out the call for today.
This concludes today's conference.